Remember, you can stay up to date on the latest news with the Irish Independent WhatsApp channel.
Seachtain, an Indo-Askeilige.
Táim I mon iarachtaí a dhéanamh teacht ar a chur, agus súligam amach an seo, gur féidir é a chur in uaig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara I gcuir na meáin an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gnám go raibh orthchar an reachtam. Iadach sé tarann go raibh an orthchar san I lis dúthail agus go mbeadh fanacht gáir a chloig sár ducha sin éachar. Ná ní bhíonn ann tar d'oraibh sé sin. Vin Marav.
Seachtain. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
Hello and you're welcome to the Big Tech Show with me, Adrian Wechler, the tech editor of the Irish and Sunday Independent. This week I'm talking to a very, very famous figure in the history of Irish tech and the internet, Jerry McGovern of Nua. Jerry, you're welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Adrian. Thanks for having me.
Jerry, we're going to talk today about your latest book, which is called Worldwide Waste. We're going to get into that. You've actually written, I think, 8 books at this point.
8 books, yeah.
8 books. So you've been pretty busy. I just want to ask you a little bit first about some of those early days, about building Nua, about what the climate was like in Dublin at the time. What do you remember about that period?
I remember one week, there was 3 of us started. Niall O'Sullivan, who went on to, has developed a very successful business from a kind of the ashes of Newer, the software, and Anton O'Loughlin. And I remember myself and Niall one week taking the Golden Pages, the business directory, and I took A to M and he took N to a Z, and we rang every, this was about 1996 or so, 95. We rang every single business, I think, practically in Ireland, and we didn't get a single inquiry, you know, from, you know, what's the internet? What's that? Or, you know, what do you talk? You know, like it was very, in the early years, it was desperation.
Because what were you trying to sell them?
Well, we were trying to sell them a website, you know, you know, back then it was build a website, the most basic, you know, thing that you could get going on. And, you know, then I remember we were working away trying to do these sort of little clever things like, how do you calculate if you need a website? You know, these walkthrough things where you're asked a series of questions and stuff like that. And we got some, interest from Declan Ganley, who of more recent fame in all sorts of worlds and things like that. And Declan got on to us and said, oh, I know all these investors and Wall Street and everything. And it was all, we were amazed. We were thinking, oh, he's really interesting. And he was. But then it all fell through, you know, so there was all this big promise of bringing you and meet Wall Street. And then that disappeared, and we were just 3 of us were sitting there.
At that point, when that contact had been made, like, what were you thinking? What was the best case scenario for you?
Well, we didn't know, because you were just, you know, I just came across the web, you know, maybe around 94 or something, and I was a freelance journalist at the time. And
you worked for Hot Press, right?
I worked for Hot Press and anyone who'd take me and bits and pieces, but mainly for Hot Press, mainly as a music journalist. But I was doing a bit of technology journalist for Technology Ireland, because I just had an interest in that area. And I saw the internet and I just thought, this is going to change the world, you know, this. And I didn't know how, you know, how we'd get involved. But, you know, I convinced Anton O'Loughlin was already into it. I found him on some discussion boards, and I convinced Niall O'Sullivan, who was an industrial designer at the time. I said, we don't know exactly what we're going to do, but we got to get into this and we got to get started. And so
at the time when, for example, by the stage that you were starting to talk to potential investors, as you thought, maybe Declan Ganley, maybe others, what was it that you thought that this might lead to?
One of the things we were trying to really drive was this concept that became Local Ireland at Aircom. And it was a community type, but within an Irish context. So it was a structured community type of environment with the idea was that, you know, that you'd have a kind of a common structure for all the counties and the parishes where everybody could come on and, you know, they'd have the same architecture, information architect. And it was about to create this community type.
Hyper-local.
Hyper-local type of stuff. So that was our core concept that we were selling. But then it was just consultants. And we ended up, we got a contract. We got one of the first contracts in the States with the American Export Register, where we designed basically a very primitive search engine and a directory, a database to allow their directory to be translated into multiple languages. I was about 97, 98. So we were dabbling in lots of bits and pieces.
I remember at the time, I didn't start in tech journalism actually till about 2000, 99, 2000. And I was in journalism actually in one of Hot Press's rivals in Dublin magazine from 97 to 99, also doing a bit of rock journalism. But I do remember even back in those days, Nua was one of the companies that was referenced enough. Like you had like Trintech and Baltimore, and Nua was right up there in terms of how it was referenced. But about 80% of people you talked to didn't really know what Nua did or what it was trying to actually...
Well, one of the reasons we were known so well is that we did another thing, which was a kind of like very early blogging. I did this report for the Irish government. That was what got me going. It became Ireland, a digital age, the internet, from about 94 to 96. And as I was doing the report, I was finding out lots of sources, where's the growth and statistics. And I thought, wow, I think lots of people are probably looking for that sort of stuff, you know, statistics. So I created this page or this site where I amalgamated all the latest trends in you know, what was happening in different countries. And it was just a little snippet and then a link to the story. So it's kind of like early blogging and amalgamation of stories, something like Google News, but a very, very early manual built version of that. And that became hugely popular for a while. We had about 250,000 people. And so we were over in New York and Javits Center at the Internet World. And people said, oh, new. But of course, they knew us for new internet surveys.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't necessarily know the other stuff. But that's what made us world famous in the sense, because loads of people were needing that sort of, because they were putting proposals together. Where am I going to get data on the growth of the internet? And we were a kind of one of the very first a kind of portals that amalgamated all that statistical data on the growth of the internet. And that's kind of what made us famous in a way.
There was a nice story I saw somewhere, I don't know if it's true or not, where you said you came up for the idea for internet surveys from listening to rap music.
Probably, yeah. Well, that was, you know, I mean, the idea of sampling.
Sampling,
you know,
yeah.
I often, about picking bits and pieces and picking the best pieces and stuff like that. Yeah, that was a kind of, you know, I'd forgotten that now, you know, but I interviewed Ice-T.
You interviewed Ice-T?
I did, yeah.
For
Hot Press many years ago. So I was big into Public Enemy in the early days and that sort of stuff. And
It's kind of almost hard to imagine because the rap scene back, my naive suburban exposure to the rap scene was like Run DMC, the Beastie Boys.
Yeah.
It didn't really extend too much further than that. People like Ice-T and Ice Cube were considered to be dangerous, you know, they're considered to be kind of edgy. And then NWA came along and all that kind of stuff.
And Boogie Down Productions, I don't know if you remember them, or I had a bit of a political angle as well, and I was involved, not directly in politics, but I was interested in that. A lot of there was this side of Gil Scott-Heron, you know, I don't know if you ever heard of him so much, but he was very early, he would do a lot of spoken word type of stuff, so there was a kind of this political angle of rap as well. There was also, and then I think when Public Enemy came along, 94, 95, they blew up in a lot. NME really were them on the front page. They were album of the year for, you know, 2 or 3 years. And
I actually saw Public Enemy in, I think it was the RDS. At that point, I mean, they were great, but at that point, they did.
I think they had lost it a bit.
It did occur to me that they had sort of gone over into Pepsi Cola, branding stuff.
I think we were at the same gig, right. And I was disappointed by that. They didn't have that, you know. You still had what you call them with the huge big clock.
Taser. What's his name? The same letter starts this. It's something.
I know. It's terrible.
What? Flavor Flav.
That's it. He still had his big clock, but they didn't have the energy. I think they had lost a bit of it by the time we were seeing them.
There was a very successful tech entrepreneur now, super awesome, Dylan. Oh God, my name's is absolutely going. I mean, he used to write a column for me for about a year.
Right.
And it was a tech column. It was a really good column on how to do it, treat staff and everything. And he's had a few companies along the way, but he was a rap obsessive. He'd start every column with a rap quote and end it with a rap quote. And some of the quotes weren't family newspaper quotes, you know?
I know,
he stopped writing for me after about 9 or 10 months, but why can't I remember? Dylan. Oh God, it'll come to me before the end of this podcast. Right. Anyway, okay. Anyway, listen, moving on. So knew it came about. You had this incredibly successful newsletter as well. And then Local Ireland well. And then Aircom or Telecom Air at the time came in.
Yeah.
And this was one of the big things. We weren't used to this in Ireland. You know, a startup selling a big chunk to a big company for £5 million or something. I mean, what was that like at the time?
It was surreal, and the whole. I remember that whole. I remember, we were going for another round, and we had all these big investment companies coming in to see us. And at one stage, we were valued something ridiculous, like €250 million or something, or dollars. And I remember saying to Niles, saying, "Well, Aer Lingus is valued at €300 million or so, €350 million. How could we be valued at it?" It was you were just thinking, this is so, and it became, you know, you were part of almost, I don't know if you'd say pyramid scheme or this kind of gold, or this fanatical, or this moment of, you know, madness.
Well, this was the late 90s, wasn't it? I mean, this was
the late 90s.
This is Baltimore Technologies valued at, I don't know, it was a billion or two.
But not just valued,
it floated. It was a traded commodity, it's a stock market. Trintech was the Iona Technologies was
Iona
the other
Technologies.
Huge one. And you worked with Trintech, right?
We certainly had relationships, you know, did bits and pieces of work. And it was great. It was a tremendously exciting time that you often felt, what's happened? I'm out of my depth, you know. It was just, everything was moving so quickly. And I remember looking at one investor guy saying, "And you're going to have to open 20 offices now within 18 months in your..." I was thinking, how do you do it? Oh, don't worry about that. You know, and it was just that sort of frenetic. You got to grow extraordinarily fast, and you got to, you know, because you got to create that momentum, etc. And so it was a real roller coaster. And then, of course, it crashed.
Yeah, well, it did. But the crash was really only a 4 to 5 year gap, 6 year gap until most of what was being built at that time really came back with a vengeance. I mean, Amazon's obviously the great story, you know.
It did. You know, I think somebody, you know, it was a real, you know, chastening type of time when it all, you know, fell asunder. And you know, you can see 1,000 mistakes and that occurred. But I think the basic ideas you know, that of around content management or around structure, around, you know, the social space. Like the local Ireland had new AdWords been launched a little bit earlier, stuff like that. And I know there's problems I talk about in the book with the advertising model, but we had no model. We had this community and a fair, reasonable amount of traffic, but there was no model to monetize it. And you know, the booking, the B&B, we had a relationship with a company in Kerry that was managing the booking engine, but the booking engines were very, very primitive. Mm. It was very difficult to book a... we were trying to hook into bed and breakfast and stuff like that. But it was just, it was too painful to book a bed and breakfast. You know, the technology was just not mature enough.
I remember in 99, I worked for the Sunday Business Post, and I was put on a beat to try and talk to local businesses around the country, ring them up and say, and ask them, what do you think of e-commerce technology? What are you considering? And most of them, and these were small businesses, like, and some of them would have been B&Bs. And the common answer at the time was, we are currently investigating the possibility of getting an email address. I mean, that was the level. Even if you had come up with the AdWords model and there was a framework for you to do that, I'm wondering whether you think that you still would have been able to run with it. I mean, would you have had the probably ruthlessness not. And the, like, you look at the Google guys, you look particularly Zuckerberg, you look at guys like Bezos. I mean, they are driven. They're driven.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. I think probably, you know, and the tech foundation, you know, that they ultimately began to build all the, you know, technological expertise around them and where they were. Yeah, I mean, they basically destroyed all before them. They're either buying or killing or, you know, so, you know.
Assimilating. They're like the Borg.
They are. And I think, you know, that's a larger, bigger problem. I think, you know, when you look at how devastated with this COVID-19 small businesses have been and how, you know, Zuckerberg and Bezos are 100 billion richer, and how this concentration of power and wealth is just accelerating. But that's another story. Yeah. Probably we wouldn't have succeeded. I think you know, it's hard to guess, but certainly we had a lot of weaknesses as well.
Mm. You've become quite critical in the last few years, I think it's fair to say, as anybody who follows you on Twitter, for example, would know, and also some of the essays and the posts that you write on jerrymcgovern.com. I don't know if is the right word disillusioned, critical, cynical. What? Because you're pretty angry about a few of these things.
I think the dream, or that you thought that this was a great emancipation, you know, that this would be a distributed network, you know, that this would really, and to see really, no, it's kind of the opposite that has happened, and that there's this incredible concentration of power in technology companies, and that these technology companies, like I saw this chart last week where they said the average US employee pays about 25% tax, the average US technology company pays 5% tax. Not alone do they make fabulous profits, which are way bigger than any businesses like them, you know, the margins that they have, but they pay practically nothing on those fabulous profits. I don't know how they've managed to really do. I think it's one of the greatest cons of the last 50 years, how they've able to concentrate so much wealth and so much cash to make incredible margins and pay hardly any tax. I mean, they've got really clever people working with the politicians.
Well, isn't the received wisdom that it's just scale, that because it's their internet businesses, they've never had to deal with the physical borders, regulatory borders, political, legal borders.
And why not? Isn't that mad, Adrian? Why not? Like, why do the rest of us have to? Why? How did they get this dispensation that they don't, you know, that they don't, even for years, VAT was a, oh, shouldn't we, shouldn't even have to pay VAT?
Yeah.
Like, they were even saying, well, why should we even have to pay? How the hell? And I think part of it is the magic, the technology, the halo of magic that, oh, because when I see a lot of senior people, either politicians, or, I remember once dealing with the UK government this guy was telling me, he says, let me tell you about senior civil servants, you know, and how they react to technology. And anyway. Yeah, they, you know, when technology comes up, they either go, or they try and get under the table. So it's either one or two react, they're scared shitless of it, they don't understand it, or else they go, it's the magic, I don't understand it, but I love it, it's the future, it's everything like that.
But was that not the reaction for you when you were writing the report for government back in the late 90s, or when you were approaching some of these big companies? I mean, one or two of them, they must have reacted like that as well, did they?
Well, they did, you know, absolutely. But it's still, even to this day, there is a lack of understanding of technology, or, you know, a kind of that it gets away with things that are, you know, these tech companies.
Yeah. What about the argument that these companies would make, or probably the PR people would make, is that that if you take a company like Amazon or Apple or Facebook or Google, yeah. Like four of those five, or Microsoft, four of them are now worth over $1 trillion. Four of them are now valued at over $1 trillion. And that has only happened since the pandemic started. Yeah. But they would say that the concentration of wealth there is distributed because they're publicly traded stocks, which means that your pension fund and my pension fund probably has shares in them. So whereas Jeff Bezos is definitely ticks a lot of the boxes for a Dr. Evil. Tim Cook, I'm not sure if Tim Cook has been here. He might be a billionaire at this point.
Yeah.
But it's a slightly more, just because so many individuals and so many companies own a piece of Apple.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, there's an argument. But at the same time, look at what Apple is doing with App Store and they're in trouble on that.
Yeah.
But they're becoming countries, bigger than countries than themselves. And we look at the real pressure, like if all of those companies disappeared tomorrow, would society really be that worse off?
Well, presumably something would just sweep in and replace what they were doing.
Well, they might, but when you think of it, Adrian, because that's another thing I was thinking of, all this stuff, what does it really do for society? You know, what has it made health much, for all the investment in health and technology, has the lifespan jumped forward 20 years? I mean, if you look at this modern tech thing, I kind of really took off in the 70s, right? Middle-class wages have flatlined. The middle class is shrinking. In every tech-rich company, the middle class is in decline. All these jobs that they're creating, other than the jobs that I do and that we're lucky in the space in warehouses. I mean, it's like slave labor. I mean, it's like you're monitored every second. You can hardly go to the toilet in these. They're monitoring every step you take.
You're painting a very dark picture here, Jerry. This is like 1984.
Well, I think it's something we really need to look at, Adrian, in that what sort of world are we creating? I mean, what has happened to the middle class? It's not doing well. It's not doing well in the US. It's not that doing so for all these benefits.
In Ireland, it's arguably doing okay. We're talking, this is a very local example. But in Ireland, if you look at the middle class today, compared to, say, the middle class, say 25 years ago or 30 years ago, it's very hard to say that we're not considerably better off now than we were.
You know, if we look at the macro picture of economies, things really improved after the Second World War, maybe not in Ireland, but they really improved.
In the States anyway, yeah.
And in nearly all of Europe, maybe a 10-year gap, but after the 50s kicked in, and things really got good up until about the early 70s. And then either with the oil crash, but from the early 70s onwards, most, you know, it's much better than the 50s. But from the 70s onwards, things have not really got from all this investment. And this is what I, looking at Adrian in the book, this I was thinking, well, all these companies I've seen over the years, and I've seen the inside of a lot of these big companies, and I've looked at the tech, 90% of the tech is crap. 90% of intranet, the internal systems that employees are given are so atrociously badly designed, out of date, old, you know, database here. 90% of data that is created is never used 3 months after it's created.
And why do you think that is? Like, I know exactly what you're saying. Anybody who's looking at this or listening to this podcast knows exactly what you're saying. They go into typically a corporate intranet or their company, and there's all sorts of bizarre, stupid pathways that you follow, things that don't make any sense. I've always put it down to the fact that somebody bought a software license or a version 7 or 8 years ago. Budgets have been tight. They haven't been able to swap it in, swap it out. Therefore, they're still working off a 2011 version of something, and that's just the way it keeps ticking over.
Well, it's something like that, Adrian. And well, number one, you know, most are going to never get rid of old systems. So, oh, this system is crummy. Well, we'll buy a new one, but won't replace the old one. Because the old one has important data on it, and we don't have time to take that data. So then you go forward 10 years and you got 10 training systems, right, in the process. But the other thing is that the sell of technology companies, and it was easily bought by CIOs, is technology is magic. It's a human free resource. It replaces people. You don't need management. It's magic. Oh, it self-organizes. Just add content, right? So, you know, you get these systems where the whole concept and budget was to install them. And there is nothing, there is no planning on architecture. There is no effort in architecture. There's no professional. There's no ongoing management of those systems. There's no continuous improvement of those systems. And also, internally,
are we not supposed to be living, though, in a cloud-hosted environment now where Amazon Web Services hosts it and somebody else looks after the content management?
True. But, Adrian, crap on the ground is the exact same as crap in the cloud. It's still crap. It's raining crap on you, right? You're walking in crap. It's still the same smell. It's still the same shit. Mm-hmm. You know, so it doesn't matter where it is. If it's not well organized, it doesn't matter whether it's in Pluto or on Mars or in the cloud or in your local server. It's not well organized. It's badly created data. We look at the stuff with AI now. You know, AI has been fed both biased data and crappy data. Like, one of the problems in AI systems in gene splicing is that they're making loads of mistakes because a lot of the data came out of Excel sheets, and a lot of the Excel sheets turned the gene code into dates because they looked, because it was eight numbers or whatever. So they've all these problems in feeding, you know, the data is badly managed in so many environments because nobody cares about the data, because they bought this idea that technology was this type of magic or this type of God, and it didn't actually require management and effort to actually truly make it work well.
And one, you know, coming back to your book, one of the themes of your book is that a lot of this ends up as waste or digital waste.
As waste.
And the idea, the concept of digital waste for some might be a difficult one, because who cares? It's digital waste. We're in an era now where we can waste loads of digital. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have the same effect. But you actually point out that digital waste can actually have a physical impact on the environment.
But everything digital is physical. So every byte that has an electrical component, I mean, it cannot not be electrical, you know. So all of these, the estimates that these data centers, right, that in Ireland, what are they estimating in 2028? 30% of our electricity. Now, that's not talking about water, you know, another for cooling in the process, right? But what I'm not saying, let's stop this, let's go back. I grew up in a small farm. We didn't even have a tractor. I don't want to go back. I like technology. But if 90% of the data is crap, we don't need it. We're just collecting it for the sake of it. We're never going to use it. Why don't we put a little bit of thinking into making sure we've good quality data in the processes? And then we can have everything and not have the waste. Because I did this kind of, in the last 2 years, we've created more data than in all of previous civilization.
That sounds about right, yeah.
Right. And by 2035, and I looked at a number of studies, they estimate we should have over 2,000 terabits of data. I'm not even going to estimate. A terabit of data is so big, it's almost unbelievable. Now, based on current storage prices, that would cost $60 trillion to store.
Mm-hmm.
That's not, the global economy is worth $80 trillion. We are creating data at a pace that is just, it's unbelievable. And most of it is poor quality, unnecessary. And it actually gets in the way. When I worked with most internets over the years, or big organizations, Microsoft or whatever, I remember once working with, doing a lot of work with Microsoft, and they had 15 million pages on Microsoft.com, 4 million of which had never been accessed. Like the population of Ireland of pages that nobody's ever looked at.
Yeah.
And you wonder, why?
Oh, look, because you could make the same argument for actually quite a lot of books as well. There's a lot of books. My family is in publishing, and a lot of books never get beyond 150 sales, and all of the effort that went into that.
You're right. And the problem is there's a book inside everyone, and the internet let the book out.
One of the things I like about the way you approached this book is I'm reading here from what you said, and you said that it's you're comparing it to Top Tasks, which is something you were actually well known for. You worked with a lot of big companies. This idea of how to streamline the way you do things, but you said your Top Tasks its EPUB file size was 5.5 megabytes. And you managed to get worldwide waste down to 0.35 megabytes.
Yeah.
And so this is a 94% reduction.
Yeah.
So therefore, and you make the point that actually that ultimately would be lighter on the environment and less polluting.
Well, it would, because there's a basic law of connectivity, or whatever we want to call it, Adrian, in relation to a megabyte has a consequence of energy. Right. And energy has a consequence of CO2, of pollution. Mm. So every megabyte, it's only a fractional we're talking about, but it's almost the lowest cost is the most dangerous cost because it seems invisible. So if you're downloading 5 megabytes, it has more impact than if you're downloading 0.5 megabyte.
I get that. And there was somebody made a good analysis. I think it's something you pointed out as well, that in relation to an ebook, for example, or an ebook reader, the amount of energy that goes into making an Amazon Kindle, for example, a waste, based on the number of books that a typical person reads, which is between 4 and 6 per year or something, it would take something like 20 years.
It would take a long time. Mm. And see, this is what we forget. You know, most of the energy in digital is actually in the construction of the devices. About 80% of the energy is in the construction of devices. Now, when you combine that with short life cycle for digital devices, you're into a very wasteful environment. So the device within which we consume the digital is most of where the energy comes, and most of it is not actually in its use, it's in its actually manufacture, in its process. Mm. But we never think about that. We never think, because people say, oh, well, I'd have to be using my computer for something, you know, or, you know, yeah, but you like, if you use it for less things, you'll have it for longer. And if you keep your computer for 4 years versus 3 years, that is a significant saving in physical waste and digital waste, et cetera.
That's if you have one computer. I mean, I shudder to show you what my desk right now
is
like. I can tell you it's more than one computer.
I know. Well, Adrian, I'm like Paul or whatever in the road to Damascus. I mean, I'm ashamed that, you know, I'm looking at this on a small laptop downstairs, and I have an office with the biggest screen I could find, and, you know, and it was only a couple of years ago. It just, because I think it was Greta Thunberg and stuff like that, and I was thinking, oh, that's great, and I was feeling chuffed with myself that, sure, I'm working in technology, isn't technology very green and everything like that, and you know, all these devices, we create more physical e-waste. Every year, that would cover Manhattan.
How do you mean we create e-waste? Do you mean the construction of gadgets and computers?
When we throw away all the stuff that gets thrown away in e-waste, right? E-readers and laptops and desktops.
Got it,
would cover Manhattan and in every year. And it's something like 50 million tons a year. And it's estimated to grow to about 120 million tons.
What about companies like Apple, which they went out with a big thing a month ago saying that they were going to try and get to a carbon neutral situation in their entire manufacturing process. Yeah. You then have companies like Amazon, which just this week, maybe it was late last week, they announced they're building a new wind farm in Galway, which with the other wind farms in Donegal and Cork will give them, I think, said it was 225 megawatts, I think, which would, they say, the equivalent of powering 180,000, but it's for their data centers. So maybe some of these big tech companies are starting to cotton on to this.
But we're addressing the wrong problem, Adrian, because it's not an energy consumption or production problem we have. It's an energy consumption problem we have. These windmills have got to be manufactured. The electricity, one of the worst environmentally damaging gases is leaked from electricity wires. I think it's called SF6. It's about 2,000 times more damaging than CO2. So a lot of these things...
How much of that gets out? How much of that leaks?
I saw a BBC report which said a lot of it is leaking out because a lot of the electrical infrastructure is creaking in a lot of countries. But the issue, right, it's better. But the issue is, now I can create even more stuff, you know, in the process. We need to consume less stuff and consume it better and have less devices and less, you know, I think it's a bit like greenwashing in some degrees. Oh, yeah, it's okay for me to leave the screen on all day because it's renewable energy. Mm-hmm. You know, renewable energy does not give us an excuse to behave more, you know, environmentally. We're doing it physically. You know, we've cottoned on. We worried about the plastic. We're trying to put the glass in bottles and stuff like that. But once we get into digital, we just go drunk wild.
The typical behavior in a typical family now, compared to say even 5 years ago, is that once the kids are over 11 or so, they all have at least one digital device. So they'll all get their own phone. There's usually one or two tablets floating, right? There'll be one laptop. Yeah. There's at least one TV, probably two TVs. You know, there's a lot going, and that's before you talk about headphones, AirPods, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, and by the way, that's before we get into smart speakers, you know, Alexa.
Yeah, it's crazy.
All that kind of stuff. So I'm just trying to figure out, Where is the scope? What should we be doing there? Which of that material should we be potentially leaving out?
Well, you know, one thing that I looked at, you know, I had an e-reader and I said, well, I says, no, I'll read the book on my phone if I have to, you know, I don't need the big screen. I'll put on my glasses, you know, you can make choice, or even stuff. There was a study in the US which says somewhere between 20 and 30% of a typical electricity bill is caused by what they call vampire power, right? And vampire power is certainly devices that are always on that are consuming power. I think another crucial thing, Adrian, is having people coming up with ways, and I know there are attempts at this in Google Nest or whoever, of telling us how much energy we're consuming. Because if you've got your smart device triggering your TV, depending on the age of your TV, that can be extraordinarily energy intensive in the process. You know, so there's all sorts of clever stuff like that. And going back to basics, you know, burn your own energy. You know, if you want Alexa to turn off the bloody light, think of all where that's going in a data center and maybe in Galway or maybe in Arkansas or whatever and back and forth. Whereas it would be much better for you just to get up and turn off the bloody light yourself, you know?
Yeah. It's impossible to argue with that point. You're from a health perspective. It's completely right as well. I'm just wondering, is it going to get to a critical point before people will start to think that way? Because these things are so damn convenient. They're so convenient.
I know. Well, this is what kills it. Like I'm doing an analysis with a couple of people now at the moment to try and understand the energy impact of programming languages. So you're a developer and you can do, say, a form on a website, and now you can do it in HTML because HTML has got much better. But instead, you'll do it in JavaScript because that's developer convenience, because it's easier to keep as much in JavaScript as possible. It makes life easier. But if we can calculate and say, well, actually, because the energy impact is not from your side, it's from every time that form is used. Right, and every time that JavaScript is downloaded. So if we can do a calculation which says, if you create this in HTML, it creates a 3x energy impact on the person's computer when they load that form. But if you do it in JavaScript, it's a 10x. You know, because people are not conscious of that either as developers. I think it's raising the consciousness that just from the start that digital takes energy. You know, it's not energy free. Most people, like I've had people send me emails saying, what do you mean it's a bad thing to have a 10 megabyte picture? Why is it a bad thing? You know, then a 1 meg, this photographer's getting in touch with me. And I have to explain to them, listen, if it's a 1 megabyte picture, you know, it downloads faster and it's storage.
Oh, and actually for most screens, it's fine. I'm always talking about this because we're now beginning to migrate from an era of 4K into 8K. And
but that's ridiculous, Adrian.
I actually have a phone. I'm reviewing a phone. Hands up. I am part of this consumer kind of thing. I review products. Part of what I do for a living, right? But I've got a phone at the moment. It's a Samsung Note 20 Ultra. It records in 8K. Now, it records video in 8K. Now, there is no way you'll ever...
Exactly.
I don't think you'll ever be able to meaningfully watch 8K on any screen under 25 inches or something. And yet it's still there. And the size of the files, a 10-second clip on that takes, I think, it's about 100 megabytes, something like that.
Ah, it's insane.
Whereas actually a 1080p, even 4K is kind of overkill. It's 1080, overkill. 1080p or even 720p for that size screen is actually fine.
Yeah.
So I know what you're talking about here with the
this is you've put your like some of it makes no difference. It's just
Now having said that, I have seen myself firsthand most of the normal tellies that you now buy in Tesco are 50 inches or bigger.
Yeah.
If you have a 50-inch telly, there is no question that 4K does look better than 1080p right now. So if you've paid for your Netflix and you've a choice to, it's going to use a hell of a lot more data to stream an hour of 4K.
Yeah.
And yet it does look better, you know?
Well, maybe four at a stretch, but definitely not eight.
No, God, no. No,
and,
I mean...
And eight, and how much, Adrian, relatively speaking, if a 4K file is 10 megabyte, what's an 8K file? It's about 40 megabyte, isn't it? It's like it's not like double.
If you were to watch, for an hour of 4K content streamed on a telly, usually is something like, it's I don't know, it's at least 2 or 3 gigabytes, probably more, maybe 4 gigabytes. 8K, you're getting into 10, 12, 15 gigabytes.
Yeah, it's not double. It's like...
Oh, no, because an 8K... an 8K image is more than twice as big as a 4K image. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So it's from a weight... And for these things... And this is, Adrian, behind the scenes, most of this data that I've... never gets used. It's not useful. Hmm. So just like the eye can't see it, the mind can't use it. Like we create so much stuff because we see it as limitless, because it's so cheap to store, because it doesn't seem like, but it all adds up over to the point where we have now, you know, zettabytes of data that we're creating every year instead of gigabytes a day.
Tell me, before we wrap, are you going to end up going off grid? Because I feel that's where this conversation is going.
No, absolutely. See, Adrian, I think we can have the 10% and have a great life.
Yeah.
We can have 4K or 2K and have a great life. I'm not saying don't enjoy the stuff. Just don't waste. Try and observe where the areas of waste are. And actually, when you strip the waste away, because when we work with big companies and big, when we got rid of the 80% of crap, everything got so much better. Mm. You know, the search engine worked better, the navigation worked better, everything worked better. When you actually strip out the crap out of the environment, you have a better experience. I'm not saying let's get rid of digital. I'm saying let's use it more wisely.
More streamlined,
than we have historically used. Because it's like, you know, we're like the alcoholic and we've won a pub. In the lotto, and we can't believe it. You know, we just need to stand back, and you know, and we can still enjoy this stuff tremendously. I don't want to go back. I grew up off the grid. You know, we didn't even have a tractor.
Have you never been tempted to buy a tractor? Because that's one of those things that you'd hear somebody say, we never had a tractor, and the first thing I did, I bought a tractor.
No. Well, it wouldn't have been much good in Phibsborough where I was at the time. So.
Fair enough. You know, Jerry, where can people get your book, World Wide Waste? Where can they get it?
Well, on jerrymcgovern.com, there's links to all the site. It's on Amazon, it's on there. Okay. But they can read it for free on jerrymcgovern.com, and then hopefully they think it's interesting and they might buy a copy.
Okay. Well, Jerry, it's been very, very interesting talking to him. Delighted to have this opportunity,
and
the very best of luck with the future.
And thank you. A great talking with you as well.
And that's all we have time for this week. So from me, Adrian Weckler, the tech editor of the Irish and Sunday Independent, I'll talk to you the same time next week. Bye-bye.